It's Catherine Gallagher with Hudson Mohawk Magazine here with Kathy Manley, who is the legal director for the Coalition for Civil Freedoms. So first of all, what is the Coalition for Civil Freedoms?
So hi, thanks for having me. The Coalition for Civil Freedoms was founded in 2010 by people who were unfairly treated in the war on terror with domestic prosecution. And we advocate for those people. We have a database of over 1,000 cases of people who were prosecuted not because of anything they did, but because after 9/11, the government started doing what we call preemptive prosecution. They tried to go after people who hadn't done anything out of a fear that they might someday do something. And it's basically following the Dick Cheney statement that if there's a 1% chance that somebody might attack us, we have to take them down now and be preemptive. He was talking about preemptive war, but it's the same model that the FBI has been following since 9/11. And so we advocate for those people. There's over 200 who are currently incarcerated that we feel are either unfairly convicted or sentenced overly harshly, usually both. And so we advocate for them in various ways, and we also work with their families a lot. And so we have family conferences every year. Unfortunately, this year it looks like it'll be virtual because it's a pandemic, but we bring together family members. Those have been growing and have been really empowering for the family members to get together and support each other and figure out how to best advocate for their loved ones, how to deal with the media, how to deal with lobbying, a lot of things like that. As legal director, I deal with a lot of the prisoners. I try to help them with issues that come up in the prisons because a lot of times the Bureau of Prisons or particular guards treat them extra harshly because they say, oh, you're a terrorist, you're evil, you know, and write them up for unfair violations, or there's a lot of religious discrimination. Sometimes they're not allowed to have the Quran, which is their right to have. There's a lot of issues with medical care. So I try to deal with all these things. They're all very difficult. I also sometimes file in court for people, which is what we've been doing lately with compassionate release motion. And occasionally, for other reasons, I file in court. But most of it is dealing with the prisoners directly and trying to better their prison conditions. We have published two reports based on our database explaining how most of the cases that the government calls terrorists are not really terrorists, that they never actually did anything, that they were either unfair sting operations targeting vulnerable people, or they were unfair convictions of material support for terrorism where there was no proof of intent to support violence, or they were unfair conspiracy charges, basically guilt by association, or other unfair tactics that the government uses. We also drafted a bill, which isn't getting anywhere yet, but maybe someday it will, to try to remedy these, because the law is really terrible with these kinds of cases. They can be manipulated by the informant to the point where they weren't going to do anything before, but the informant talks them into agreeing to do something in a fake case. So we wanted to change the law on that and say they have to already be taking steps in that direction.
So just to go back a little bit, what does it mean to be granted compassionate release?
It's really good timing that there was a bill passed called the First Step Act. It became law in 2019. Before that, compassionate release meant that the Bureau of Prisons could grant a motion for somebody if they were terminally ill. And even then, they didn't grant the motion. So most people died waiting for that compassionate release to be granted. So under the First Step Act, the judge has to find an extraordinary and compelling reason. And it can be based on serious medical conditions for people over 65, which are chronic conditions that are not going to improve, that make life more difficult for you in prison. They have to find that. And then they also have to show that you're not a danger to the public. It can really be for any reason, as we discovered, not just medical reasons, any extraordinary and compelling reason.
So how has the coronavirus pandemic changed the process or the amount of compassionate release forms requested?
Yeah, it's been a huge change because the CDC has made it clear that when people are over a certain age and you have certain medical conditions, you're particularly vulnerable to the virus. And you have a much greater risk of severe complications or death. And then the coronavirus started spreading in prisons, and we started a coronavirus release project. What we did was we took our list of 200 prisoners that we support, and we looked to see who on that list was over 60. And then we started writing to them and saying, you know, if they have any of these medical conditions or even based on their age, that we could file this motion for them. And so only one of ours so far got granted, and several got denied, and we still have one pending, and we are working on preparing about three more, and there may be more coming, but we have a pretty limited capacity because I'm here doing this part-time. It's basically a full-time job, but luckily we have this other attorney, Ameth, who's been working on it, and I have my intern, who is actually Yasin Arif's son, and he's a Harvard Law student. He's my intern for the summer.
So the coronavirus has clearly impacted the compassionate release process, but how has it impacted the prison system?
Yeah, it's horrible. I mean, it started out slow. You can look at a graph and it gets very steep pretty quickly as far as the number of cases. And then there's been 95 deaths in federal prison. And our people, two of them, well, one of them named Mohammed Yusuf, we didn't consider him for a motion because he was young and he was in Lompoc federal prison in California, and he contracted the virus. It was spreading like wildfire there, and in any event, he got really sick. They just threw him in solitary on a tier with other people in solitary, I guess, and he died while he was still in his cell. They found him dead, and then later we heard that other prisoners on that tier had heard him gasping for breath and begging for help and yelled, and they had banged on the bars and screamed for guards to help him get him to the ER. They did nothing. But it's just so horrible. He was supposed to get out next year. He had been locked up for quite a while. So he died, and I think that his original attorney may be pursuing a lawsuit since we discovered that all these other prisoners had tried to get the attention of the guards, and they had to know that he was suffering and that they just did nothing. The other person is Ibrahim El-Gabrouni, and he was in federal prison in Elkton. He'd been locked up since 1993, even pre-9/11, on an unfair sting operation case, and was supposed to get out next year. And he was older and more vulnerable, and I had written to him about doing a motion and had never heard back. And I guess that is because he had already contracted the virus and he became very ill. He's been on a ventilator since April. I don't think there's really any real hope of him coming back from that at this point. It's really, really sad. So it's impacted our people, with those two people in particular. And I mean, we're hoping to get people released from it, and that's sort of the silver lining, but it's a really dangerous disease, and it's really difficult in prison because it's impossible to social distance, so it spreads really fast, and the prisons are not always honest about reporting it, and they don't do much testing. They only test if you have symptoms, so it's a really difficult situation.
You've talked about these two individuals in particular, but have you been working with any one group more than others in terms of compassionate release or coronavirus in the prisons?
Well, yeah, I mean, we have our list of 200 people that, you know, we were looking at trying to help for those who are particularly vulnerable to the virus, but sometimes people die of it without any of those criteria, so it's kind of a wild card. As far as in the prison, I mean, there's certain prisons that have more and more cases than others. But now, as with the country as a whole, it's gone from like New York, California, et cetera, to everywhere else, especially in the South and the West. And that's how it gets into the prisons, is almost always from the guards that live in that community where there's a lot of cases, and then they go into the prison and they infect the prisoners, and it's impossible to social distance in prison. There's nothing they can do to protect themselves, especially in low security prisons where people are gonna get out sooner, you know, considered less dangerous. Those are the prisons where it spreads the fastest because there's a lot more contact between inmates and guards, particularly between inmates, and they don't do the testing. So it's a threat to everybody in prison, really. But, you know, certain groups are more vulnerable and certain prisons are more vulnerable.
Thank you for your time.
All right, thank you.